We'll hear arguments first this morning in 76-1121 American Broadcasting Companies against Writers Guild and the cases consolidated with that case. Mr. Cohn, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. This case presents another facet of the problem which this court considered in Florida Power 4 years ago. The question is whether Section 8B1B of the National Labor Relations Act, which makes it an unfair labor practice for a union to restrain or coerce an employer in the selection of his representatives for collective bargaining or grievance adjustment, whether a union violates this provision by threatening to discipline and disciplining supervisors who are also members of the union for crossing a picket line to perform their normal supervisory duties during a strike. Now, the facts, very briefly, are these. A respondent, the Writers Guild, represents for collective bargaining purposes writers who prepare scripts for motion pictures and television films. The employers also employ producers, directors, and story editors to manage and carry out the production of the films. The producers, directors, and story editors are supervisors within the meaning of the Act, and when engaged as such, they also represent the employers in the adjustment of grievances, and the producers also represent them in some cases for collective bargaining purposes. Some producers, directors, and story editors, known as hyphenates, and these are the people that we will be concerned with here, have writing capabilities and are at times employed by the employers as writers. The Guild represents the hyphenates only when they're employed as writers and not when they are employed as producers, directors, or story editors. Most hyphenates have personal service contracts with the employers when they are so engaged. The collective bargaining agreement with the Guild provides that a person subject employed in a non-writing capacity, such as a producer, writer, or director, is not covered by the agreement. The agreements further provide that producers, directors, and story editors may engage in certain editorial writing functions called A to H functions without becoming subject to the agreements. Now, in March of 73, the Guild began a strike against the employers in furtherance of their demands for new contracts covering the writers. The strike continued against some employers until July of that year. A month before the strike started, the Guild distributed strike rules to all members, including the hyphenates. In addition to prohibiting writing for struck employers, the rules prohibited all members, regardless of the capacity in which they were working, from crossing the union picket lines. The union strike rules also prohibited union members from working in the future with members who violated the strike rules. And the Guild, through a special meeting of the hyphenates and the phone calls to particular hyphenates, emphasized that the strike rules would apply to the hyphenates working in any capacity and that they would be subject to discipline and blacklisting if they crossed the picket lines. The employers, on the other hand, demanded that the hyphenates continue, notwithstanding the strike and the picket lines, to perform their duties other than as a writer under their personal service contracts. Some hyphenates crossed the picket lines to perform their normal supervisory and managerial functions as producers, directors, and story editors. They performed no writing work which would otherwise have been performed by the striking writers. Many hyphenates did not go to work. During and after the strike, The Guild filed internal charges against 31 of the hyphenates for crossing the picket line. And 10 of them were subsequently convicted and were suspended or expelled from union membership, and fines ranging from $500 to $50,000 were assessed. Later, the union membership voted to reduce the penalties of 9 of the convicted hyphenates. Upon charges filed by the employers, the board, with member Fanning dissenting, concluded that the Guild had violated Section 8B1B of the Act by disciplining and threatening to discipline the hyphenates for crossing the picket line to perform their normal supervisory duties. Now, Florida Power holds that a union's discipline of one of its members who is a supervisory employee can constitute a violation of Section 8B1B only when that discipline may adversely affect the supervisor's conduct in performing the duties of and acting in his capacity as grievance adjuster or collective bargainer on behalf of the employer. Now, the discipline in Florida Power was found not to have this effect because the supervisors were disciplined for crossing the picket line to engage in rank-and-file struck work, which is neither collective bargaining or grievance adjustment, nor any activities related thereto. We submit that a different conclusion is called for, whereas here the supervisor crosses the picket line to perform his normal supervisory duties, and they include, as was true in this case, grievance adjustment and collective bargaining functions. Now, there are two bases on which we believe we can satisfy the Florida Power test. The first referred to as a deprivation theory, and the other is a carryover theory. Turning to the deprivation theory first, we believe that the threats of discipline restrain the employers in their selection of a representative for grievance adjustment and collective bargaining no less than if the union had engaged in a direct strike to obtain the removal of a disfavored foreman with such authority would have done. For two reasons. Insofar as the threat kept hyphenates away from work, and it appears that about 100 of them did not go to work, the employers were deprived of their services, which included grievance adjustment and collective bargaining. Insofar as the hyphenates defied the union and went to work, and about at least 31 did because they were the number that were disciplined, the employers will nonetheless have been coerced by the union's threats because the legality of a threat is not dependent upon its effectiveness, and the strike rules here were in effect for at least a month before the strike started, before the employer was able to ascertain who would or would not come to work. Now, in the first argument of this case, the union conceded that if it had threatened to discipline the hyphenates for crossing the picket lines to perform grievance adjustment or collective bargaining functions, it would have violated Section 8B1B, irrespective of whether the threat was effective. It contends, however, that the board hasn't proved that the union's threats deprive the employers of their representatives for grievance adjustment or collective bargaining purposes, because there is no finding, first, that the hyphenates stayed away because of the threats rather than the picket line, and two, there is no finding that the union intended to fine the hyphenates for performing grievance adjustment and collective bargaining functions, as distinguished from performing their other supervisory duties. Now, we submit that these contentions don't stand up for these reasons. In the first place, since the union threatened the hyphenates with discipline if they went to work in any capacity, we submit that the burden is on them, under familiar principles of law, to disentangle the consequences for which they are chargeable from those from which they are immune. You do not have just a picket line in a strike and supervisors electing not to honor that picket line. Secondly, as I pointed out, the union threatened the hyphenates with discipline if they went to work in any capacity. They knew that the employers had asked the hyphenates to perform their normal supervisory duties, that these included grievance adjustment and collective bargaining, and that with the other employees remaining at work, as they did, it was likely that they would be called upon to engage in grievance adjustment and collective bargaining, and the record shows that they, in fact, were. In these circumstances, we submitted...
How does the record show that they were engaged in collective bargaining? Maybe I have a limited view of what of the definition of collective bargaining, but it seems to me that that has to do with negotiating a collective agreement.
Well, the record shows that the producers, when they were on location, were frequently called upon to enter into on-the-spot agreements to cover people that had to be hired to perform services. The producers are the only ones that on occasion were required to engage in collective bargaining. The others adjusted grievances, and the record does show that they did adjust grievances because they were shooting films. There was no new writing going on, but there were prepared scripts before the strike, and film, and they were being filmed. You had actors at work, you had the other people other than writers. And there were.
Well, you include grievance adjustment as part of collective bargaining.
In addition to collective bargaining, it's nearly not part of it, is it? Under the statute, it says for the purpose of collective bargaining or the adjustment of grievance.
Well, the statute does distinguish the two. I think that you could make a good argument that the concept of collective bargaining, as it is understood in labor-management relations, could in a broad sense include the day-to-day administration of the agreement, and insofar as the adjustment of grievances under the contract is part of that day-to-day administration of the contract, that's part of the process of collective bargaining.
Well, tell me, Mr. Combe, if an employer refuses to process grievances under the collective bargaining agreement, can that be the basis of an 8B5 charge?
If the an 8A5 charge.
8A5 charge.
Yes.
So it is collective bargaining, isn't
it? It is. Justice Stewart is correct, however, that Congress distinguished it too in this statute. I submit that it wasn't necessary to separate the two out. Collective bargaining would have covered the whole thing.
In other words, if that second phrase had been omitted, it would be no different at all. That's your position.
That is correct.
Now, was there a collective bargaining agreement in existence? And if so, what was the strike about?
Well, there was a collective. There were agreements covering these other people who were working during the strike, the actors and the cameramen and the others that go to work that have to be employed in producing a film. This is not a situation where you have the plant shut down, and there's nobody at work. I mean, the supervisors merely go in there to update their records or something.
Keep the heat on or something.
Keep the heat on. You had a going operation here. I would like to not cut in further into my colleague's time. Thank you.
Very well, Mr. Cohn. Mr. Caton.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, in the time allotted to me, I would like to primarily discuss what has come to be called in this case the deprivation theory. It is basically a very straightforward and simple theory, as it was described by the administrative law judge in this case. It doesn't require considerations such as whether something might have an effect in the future, but it deals with the present, the time of the strike. And the basic question is, does the union's pressure on a supervisor not to work by coercion and restraint and threats and discipline, foreseeably could it have the effect of preventing that person from working and thereby depriving the employer of the selected 8B1B representative, thereby coercing and interfering and, coercing and restraining the employer in such selection? The classical case on this subject was the Horner case, which is cited in our brief, in which there was no contract, and the union instructed union members to withhold their services. The superintendent on the job was a union member, and he too was instructed not to work. He disobeyed the union's orders and was punished. The National Labor Relations Board has no difficulty finding that the employer had been coerced and restrained in the selection of this supervisor, of this 8B1B representative, because the foreseeable effect of what the union did would have been that he would not have worked, or alternatively, if he did work and was punished, his services might not be available in the future. In that case, there was no refusal by any of the employees to work, including the supervisor. The effort was manifestly unsuccessful. I'm stressing that point. Post-Florida Power, we have a very similar situation. In a case involving Skippy Enterprises, now known as Wisconsin River Valley, which was affirmed in the Seventh Circuit in a decision by Judge Brecker. In that case, there was a very similar situation. There were two union elections, both lost. After the election, the union said, we will not permit any of our members to work on this job, and they told the superintendent, you cannot work or we'll punish you. He did work and they punished him. And again, the board held it to be an 8B1B, and the court affirmed on the theory that clearly, here there was a foreseeable deprivation of the employer of his 8B1B designated representative, and therefore, coercion and restraint in the selection. Now, the very important point that needs to be made is, this issue was not really before the court in Florida Power. Why? Because in Florida Power, first of all, at least in the Illinois Bell facet of Florida Power, the supervisors were told, if you want to come to work, we'd love to have you come. If you don't want to come to work, you don't have to. They were not even designated as 8B1B representatives. They were given the option to designate themselves. In Florida Power, the record is silent as to what the circumstances were because it's a stipulated record. But in both cases, the union said, if you come to work and perform your normal supervisory functions, you can do that. We will not punish you. Thereby, clearly, not interfering, not coercing, not restraining the employer in selection, if one accepts the view of the majority in Florida Power, that struck work is not part of collective bargaining or grievance adjusting and not even related to it, because the whole gamut of what a supervisor does could have been done without any interference on the part of the union. Now, the touchstone of the Florida Power case actually in the decision was the future. What future effect may the conduct of the union have? That is not necessarily needed here, even though it's present too, because we have the fact that there was an intended current effect during the strike. Now, in this case, the employers ordered the union representatives to work. They didn't give them an option. Only as supervisors, only in their normal management functions. And they were told If you do not come to work, we will discharge you and we will fine you. The union, on the other hand, said, you cannot work at all, no services in any capacity whatsoever, including, of course, grievance adjusting and collective bargaining. Now, clearly, the union's threats and the subsequent discipline had one purpose and one purpose only. One just has to look at what preceded the strike. Reactivation of withdrawn members, if you please, who had no loyalty obligations to the union whatsoever, who were paying no dues and had no union benefits. They were pulled back into the union by mandate in order to put them under the union's yoke and enable the union to force them not to work and thereby prevent the employer from selecting representatives. Now, whether or not there was collective bargaining during the strike, I submit, is not really relevant, collective bargaining in the sense of negotiating a contract. The important thing is that these people who went to work were authorized to negotiate contracts. They were designated to negotiate contracts. They were authorized and designated to settle grievances. Now, the union was in no way here relying on any appeal to the loyalty of the supervisors. Quite the contrary. It was bringing them back, drafting them, if you will. Many of them were associate members who did not have the right to vote on the strike rules and didn't vote on them. No one was allowed to resign. They were locked in. And in those circumstances, they were told, if you come to work in any capacity, we will do terrible things to you, not only now, but for the future. Namely, you will never be able to work again, putting on maximum pressure on these people in order to force them not to work now and thereby coercing the employer for the present as well as for the future. Now, the union argues here basically 4 points in defense of its position. First of all, it says that there is no 8B1B because its efforts were unsuccessful. A lot of people came to work, the ones they fined and punished and attempted to expel until the membership reversed them. Secondly, that the motive of the union here was not established to be to prevent the performance of 8B1B work, or indeed the manner of such performance. And thirdly, the union argues in effect that 8B1B is designed to protect the supervisor rather than the employer, but only in the performance of collective bargaining and grievance adjusting functions. All premises, all of those 4 premises, I would submit, are totally wrong. Beginning with the first one, success is not required, and we can cut through all the other possibilities and go straight to Florida Power, because when this court said in Florida Power that a violation can be found only if it may adversely affect the conduct of the supervisor, very obviously the court did not say will affect. It said may affect. That does not have to be success within the terms of Florida Power itself. And again in Florida Power, this court sided with approval. Cases where an 8B1B had been found, where an attempt was made to force an employer to accept only union members as supervisors. So without going beyond the decision of this court in Florida Power, it's manifestly clear that all that's involved is an attempt and not success. The number of cases in 8B1B involving only attempts are legion. The union relies on an 8A3 case to argue to the contrary. 8A3 does not deal with coercion and restraint. It deals with discrimination, where motive is important. And a lot of other things are important that are not important under coercion and restraint. As to the motive in this situation, incidentally, the question here is clearly not why the union was doing it, but what the effect on the employer is. That's the issue. Is the employer being restrained and coerced? If he is, no one cares why the union did what it did. Again, turning to the Florida Power language, the question is what the effect is, not what the motivations were. AB1B, contrary to what the union suggests in its supplemental brief, is not intended to protect supervisors. It is crystal clear under Section 2, 3, 11, and 14 of the Act that supervisors have no Section 7 rights to protect. The protection is afforded to the employer in his selection of supervisors. And furthermore, that protection is accorded to the employer not in the performance of the function, but in the selection of the persons who will perform the function. That's the issue. Now, as to the performance of the function, there was a discussion, questions from the court to counsel for the union, in which ultimately, in effect, counsel for the union conceded that if a supervisor came in with an affidavit, I believe was the language, stating, I will do only 8B1B work, I will only adjust grievances and bargain collectively, then indeed the union could not punish him. Well, Your Honors, looking at this realistically rather than academically, what we have here is a concession that a man who may be paid as much as $10,000 a week as a producer of a motion picture, or even more, can be brought in by an employer to sit there for a day, a week, a month, or maybe a year until a grievance arises, which he has a right to adjust. No one knows when grievances occur. No one can predict. And to say that employers can bring in supervisors for the sole purpose of doing 8B1B work is to say that it can be made economically impossible for them to make the selection, and therefore they have to select someone else. And to me, the situation is absolutely in no way different from the situation in California Cottage Company, 208 NLRB 994, at page 1004, affirmed by the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia in 515 Fed Second 1018, in which this court denied cert, where a labor organization, the Longshoremen's Union and the Pacific Maritime Association, entered into a contract in which they said, if any containers have to be handled that have not been staffed by longshoremen, then we will impose a tax on those containers. And it was a pretty stiff tax. And the board held and the court affirmed that the imposition of that tax was exactly the same thing as saying we will not handle the containers. And I submit in the same way in this case, one cannot say that the 8B1B rights of the employer to select the representative are really protected if he has to pay the price of having someone sit all day waiting for a possible grievance. Now, the work involved here, the last argument by the union is, of course, that some of the work here involved collective bargaining type work. Well, the A through H functions, as we discussed on prior argument, are very clearly managerial work. First of all, the contract says that they are not covered by the contract, but performed by excluded personnel. And secondly, by their very nature, the decisions involved are management decisions. In that respect, the work differs importantly from the Florida power type work for two reasons. First of all, it clearly was not work that was struck work in the legal sense of the word, or bargaining units work in the legal sense. But more importantly, it is managerial work. And it is managerial work of any sort from which grievances flow. If someone is performing management work, that's how grievances come about. And if the person who is the manager performing these functions has grievance adjustment authority, as all these people did, then it necessarily follows that the performance of these management functions is, quote, grievance related, as this court stated in Florida Power in its majority opinion. Now, basically, 8B1B, I would submit, is a policy determination unambiguously expressed by Congress, as Mr. Justice Stevens said in an opinion. Namely, and I don't mean on this subject, but on a different statute, equally unambiguously expressed here, that the intent is to protect the employer's right to select its management representatives free of coercion or restraint by the union. That's the issue. And I think the only way the court could find in favor of the Writers Guild in this case would be to, in effect, tack on to the statute a provision saying, this provision shall be inapplicable in case of a strike. I'd like to reserve my remaining time for Mr. Khan's rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Bakerly.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. I would like to make one observation concerning the deprivation theory before I talk about the adverse carryover effect theory. The Guild contends that the Board did not make findings that the threats were made to others than those who worked. I would like to submit that that statement is erroneous. In the Board's decision, in the petition at Appendix B3, the Board goes on to say that it sustains the complaint's alleged violation of Section 8B1B of the Act in toto. And 13D of the second amended complaint alleges that commencing in February, through the promulgation of its strike rules and Rule 30, its blacklist rule, and by other actions, it threatened numerous persons occupying the positions of the hyphenates, that for all times in the future, no member of respondent would work with or perform services for them if they failed to honor or otherwise support the strike described in paragraph 10 above. That, I submit, is a finding by the board that there were threats to hyphenates other than those who crossed the picket line, that they would be threatened and blacklisted if they did cross the picket line and failed to honor the strike. Now, with respect to the second theory of the board, which I would like to direct most of my time to, the adverse carryover effect theory begins with this court's decision in Florida Power, where, as has been said, the court stated that the union's discipline of one of its members who is a supervisory employee can constitute a violation of 8B1B only when that discipline may adversely affect the supervisor's conduct in performing the duties of and acting in his capacity as a grievance adjuster or collective bargainer. Now, this conduct of the guilds in this case, which Judge Moore in his dissent in the Second Circuit characterized as the guilds' in terrorem conduct, certainly would have an adverse carryover effect to supervisors in the future. Not only are the fines absolutely horrendous, $50,000 even to somebody making $5,000 a week is a substantial sum of money. The threats to expel from the union is certainly substantial. But more importantly, the blacklisting threats to creative people is absolutely an abhorrent. The fact that after the strike started, the guild rescinded Rule 30 really does not absolve the guild, or does the after effect reduction of the $50,000 fines take away the fact that the threats were made and they had an effect. The guild or any other union could blacklist in the future if this court holds such conduct unlawful. And furthermore, the role of dishonor was not rescinded at all, and there is evidence that it may well have continued in effect. Now, while the guild argues, well, individual members acting alone might have been able to refuse to work with, as they call them, scabs, certainly they couldn't do it in concert, and they couldn't do it if the guild suggested it or condoned it, and we submit that the evidence here is certainly very strong that that occurred. Now, the union says, well, the employer could take care of the effects of this after the strike by requiring resignation. In other words, he could require the supervisors to resign after the strike, and then in the future they wouldn't have the power to submit to discipline. Well, that really couldn't happen in this case. In the first place, the blacklist and the threat of the blacklist is still there.
Do you say the putting out of the blacklist or a list of people the union regards as scabs is by itself violative of the act?
Yes, I think so, Your Honor. By the union?
Yeah.
To say that you will not work with other members when your whole livelihood depends upon your ability to attract the best creative people, yes, I think that's definitely coercive.
Well, is it any different? Is there any difference in the labor law between creative people and carpenters?
I don't think so. But
they were not creative?
Maybe there is a difference. Here, the associate producer and the director's sole, their value of their services is the ability to get outstanding creative people to work with them. Now, that's not quite the same as a carpenter or someone working with a carpenter. And so I think there may well be a difference in this industry because of that situation. But nevertheless, the blacklist, to answer the question about resignation after the strike, as whether that then was the remedy for the employer, the blacklist would still be there. And remember that the record is clear that the guild had the right to prevent resignation for 2 years after the strike of any member. And of course, we submit that the self-help options really are not valid in this case because of the fact that a substantial percentage of the management people comes from the rank and file and will return to the position of writers as time passes, and that as a practical matter, resignation just is not going to get us the kind of producers that we need. Producers have to have the ability to work with the writers, And therefore, we feel that the self-help options are really not valid. There's no question of what this conduct did engender fear in the supervisors' members, and it engendered fear in to those who adjusted writers' grievances. It engendered fear in those who adjusted the grievances of other employees, because employees don't differentiate between the kind of union that that makes the threats. One union makes a threat, and they feel that any union can also make a similar threat. The record is replete with evidence of the effect of this of these threats upon upon individuals, and I won't go into that at this point in time. The carryover effect clearly restrains the selection of a supervisor, as the statute sets forth. If a union can, by threats and by fines, change the way a supervisor performs, it has in effect negated the employer's selection and has changed the supervisor. In the legislative history, Senator Taft talks about Mr. X and Mr. Y. Well, let's suppose that Mr. X is a person who rigorously enforces the contract, keeps the union employees towing the mark, and Supervisor Y is very easy and very soft upon the employees. And if that employer wants Supervisor X, certainly if the union can then fine Supervisor X to such an extent that to turn him into Supervisor Y, a supervisor that acts better toward the union members and softer toward them, the union has, in effect, changed the selection of that employer from X to Y.
But have these fines had any such effect in changing the attitude of any supervisor toward any grievance or toward any collective bargaining issue?
I think that that's a question for the board to decide, Mr. Justice Stevens, and the board is the agency which Congress has cloaked with expertise, and its experience. It has found that this kind of conduct may adversely affect the supervisors in the way they perform their grievance adjusting and collective bargaining in the future. And I believe...
But as I understood it, if both X and Y, one is soft and one is hard, both cross the picket line, they're both equally subject to the fine, equally subject to discipline, aren't they?
Well, that would be correct.
How does the discipline tend to make Y act more like X?
Well, I'm using a situation where both do not cross the line. That's the point that I'm trying to make, that you have a situation.
Well, in other words, there's just as much deterrent on Y as there is on X. I mean, whether he's tough or soft, he's equally deterred from crossing the line.
Well, certainly may well be the fact, and that, of course, goes to the deprivation theory, which is the first theory, Mr. Justice Stevens.
Yes, I understand, but you're arguing the carryover theory.
I don't really think on the carryover theory. The point I'm trying to make is we have two separate supervisors. Let's take away from the picket line for a moment. You have two separate supervisors, X, or two candidates, X and Y, and the supervisor, the employer wants X. Now, because of certain his characteristics. If the union can find X and turn him into somebody like Y, then they, in effect, have changed the employer's selection from X to Y. That's the point I'm trying to make. And it's clear from the legislative history that this was just the kind of action that Mr. Senator Taft was talking about. But employees cannot say to their employer, we do not like Mr. X, we will not meet Mr. X, you have to send us Mr. Y. That has been done. It would prevent their saying to the employer, you have to fire Foreman Jones, and therefore you will have to fire him or we will not go to work. Now, certainly we have in this case, when the Guild established this blacklist and the role of dishonor, they were really saying, here is a list of Foreman Joneses who we will not work with, and therefore a list of people the employer cannot have
all
as grievance.
All of them on the list, X, or all of them Y?
Either one.
You don't know. How can you make a statement that they were all X's or all Y's? Don't you need that to make your argument?
Well, I think you can assume that the people that the employer wanted to work were all exes. I think you can assume that.
And you can assume that the ones that the union put on there were all what? Exes or what?
While
we're assuming. Don't you have too many assumptions here?
I don't believe so, Mr. Justice Marshall. I think that what I'm using is the example of how you can turn by fines someone into a different person. That's the point I'm trying to make. It's not.
Well, was it done here?
That is for the board to decide. The board decided that it may well have been done, and that is in its expertise. That as the agency that has this experience, it made that finding, and we submit that that finding is binding upon the court below.
What?
I beg your pardon?
They supported the finding.
With inferences and with their knowledge of
assumptions that you make.
You may call on that, Mr. Justice Marshall, but that's really what Congress intended this agency to do, was to take from their knowledge of what occurs in the real everyday life, and they made the decision. And
everybody on that list was a wise man. Everyone.
I'd like to reserve, Mr. Chief Justice, the rest of my time for Mr.
You want to answer my question?
Excuse me. I thought we were through. I'm sorry, Mr. Marshall.
I said, did they assume that everyone on the list was why?
No, they did not so assume.
Mr. Chief Justice. Please, the court. Excuse me. In our view, there are two things that were clearly stated in Florida Power, which this court said to the board it has to consider, and which the board has not considered. And in not considering it, the board was able to come up with the result that it, with which it has come up. Those two things are that, first, employers have an option, an unfettered option, to have their supervisors withdraw their membership in unions, not join unions, thereby resolving what was said in 1947 to be the conflict of loyalties possibility, where a supervisor has loyalties to the union and to the employer. And the second point was that Section 8B1B was designed to protect employers in two discrete functions, collective bargaining and adjustment of grievances. In order for the board to find a violation in this case, it's had to ignore the court's rationale and ignore the legislative history.
Well, suppose the employer orders an employee to come to work and to perform grievance functions. That's all he says. Please come to work. I've got some grievances to be settled. Will you please come and settle them for me? And the employee crosses the picket line and is fined. And he crosses the picket line to perform those duties and performs them and is fined for it. Is that a violation?
That's a violation.
And if he says, please come to work generally, and part of his duties happen to be settling grievances, and he does them, and he does settle them, and the employee is then fined by the union. What about that?
That may or may not be a violation under these circumstances. In Oakland Mailers, the board took the position that a supervisor who is disciplined for the manner in which he adjusts grievances, or the manner in which he carries out his supervisory functions, that the union violates the act by restraining and coercing the employer through such discipline. And under Oakland Mailers, that would be a violation. It would be a violation if the union restrained, if the union disciplined the supervisor for the manner or because he adjusted grievances. Now, this decision goes beyond Oakland Mailers, because the board takes the position that it's not necessary to show that the supervisor had any grievance adjustment functions when he crossed the line. It's not, as an example of that, I cite you to the case of the story editors. The story editors in our case only supervised writers. This was a successful strike. There were no writers to supervise. There was no grievance to adjust. There was no bargaining for the story editors to do. Despite that, the board proceeds on the theory that so long as he has the authority, whether used or not, to adjust grievances or to engage in collective bargaining, there's a violation. And we understand the law to be that the board must come up with evidence that the union disciplined the supervisor because of the manner of his performance of his 8B1B functions or because he performed 8B1B functions.
So if the employer says to an, says to the employee, please come to work, I may have some grievances to be settled. Come over here and sit around, and if there are any, I want you to settle them. And the union, and he goes, nothing happened, no grievances, and he comes home and he's fine.
No.
Well, what about that?
I would say no fine in that. I would say that that discipline in that case
would be
violate
a violation.
The act.
Mm-hmm.
So are you saying that the board's ruling can be set aside here, as was done by the Court of Appeals, and leave Oakland Mailer's good law?
That's right. That's right. I don't think that this ruling has anything to do with Oakland Mailer's because the board in this case went beyond Oakland Mailer's.
Florida Power and Light did not overrule Oakland Mailer's, did it?
No, I'm not suggesting that it did. No. And I'm not suggesting that this court even has to get to Oakland right. Mailer's. I'm suggesting that under the theory expressed by the board, it's gone beyond Oakland Mailer's. The carryover theory, which the board expresses, says that because the supervisor will be deterred by the discipline on this occasion from crossing the union's picket line in future strikes, the discipline is a violation of the act. And I read that on page 17 of the board's brief and at page 7, note 5 of the board's reply brief. Now, that simply ignores what this court took 8 pages to express. And in Florida Power, namely that the employer can avoid this carryover effect in a future strike by requiring that the supervisor withdraw his membership from the union or by not having permitted him to be a member in the first place.
Of course, there is a difference in this case. The these employees were told very unambiguously before the strike began that they could not resign during the
yes.
course of the strike, and that is a substantial difference, in fact, between this case and Florida Power and Light and Illinois Bell and the other, isn't it?
You're right, Your Honor. It is a difference. While I would argue, first of all, I would point out that Mr. Backley was incorrect when he said that the rule was that you couldn't resign for 2 years. In fact, not that it makes a substantial amount of difference, but the rule was that you couldn't resign for 6 months after negotiations, and that was at page 579 of the appendix. But the rule was that you could resign prior to entering into the negotiations, and so that the employer had the option before the strike started, before the negotiations started. But I acknowledge that this case is a little bit more difficult because of that, but that doesn't make any difference to the board's theory because it's found a violation on this same theory in other cases, one which is presently before this court on a petition for certiorari, the Hammond case, regardless of the fact that there was not that restraint of resignation. What it comes down to, as Mr. Backley, both Mr. Backley and Mr. Keaton argued, is that it's too onerous for us to require our supervisor members to withdraw from membership in the union. And in fact, the board found in this case that it was a substantial benefit to the employers to have their supervisors members of the unions. But that's not the line that this court should draw. That's the line that Congress drew. And Congress said that the option is with the employers. And if it's too onerous, then the employers have to petition Congress, or they have to give something up. They have to give something up in terms of negotiating something in the agreement, or, as they did in this case, what they did was to tell the supervisors that we will reimburse you for any fines that you're required to pay, and we'll provide a lawyer for your defense. And that's what happened. Our view is that in Oakland Mailers, the board found a violation by union discipline for the manner in which the supervisor had carried out his supervisory duties. In the present set of cases, the board says that it doesn't matter how the supervisor carries out his supervisory duties, and it doesn't matter whether he in fact does any supervisory duties. In this case, we had what we've described in our supplemental brief as non-struck rank-and-file work. That's the A to H work. But that's not an issue so far as the board is concerned. Any discipline, for any reason other than performing 50% rank-and-file struck work, is, in the board's view, a violation. And that, it seems to us, overlooks the second major point that this court stressed in Florida Power, and namely that there's a distinct difference between 8B1B functions, the two things, collective bargaining and grievance adjustment, and those functions that are normal supervisory functions that are contained in Section 211 of the Act. Now, the board simply obliterates the distinction between them and doesn't even allude to that distinction in this court's decision. In this case, a violation was found despite, as I've said, the fact that there was scant evidence of any 8B1B functions by anybody and no evidence of any 8B1B functions, at least with respect to story editors. As an afterthought, in the board's supplemental brief, they state that the employers were restrained and coerced because in the interim, between the time that the union announced its strike rules and the time that the supervisors came to work, the employers didn't know whether they would have those supervisors at work, and therefore their production expectations were up in the air. Well, I think it's sufficient to point out that the board's argument on to that effect was not supported by a citation to the record or by a citation to a board finding, because there was none. With respect to the threats, the board based its findings of a violation on the conclusion that since the discipline is a violation, the threat is a violation. And if that's the board's theory, then the same arguments that are made with respect to the discipline are also applicable to the threats. The board's brief goes on to state the deprivation theory. And in our view, the deprivation theory requires, at a minimum, that at least under Oakland Mailers, that there be evidence of a person was restrained and coerced, a person was disciplined for the manner in which he performed his supervisory functions, a finding which was not made and which was deemed not relevant to the board's theory. Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve any remaining time for Mr. Gould.
Mr. Gould.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. In the time I have, I would like to begin by outlining the Board's various approaches to Section 8B1B, to stating the defects in those approaches as we see them, and finally to suggesting what we consider to be the proper reading of that provision. For the first 20 years after this provision, which had received the support of both the majority and the minority in the Senate, and one of the very few provisions in Taft-Hartley to do so, was enacted, the board took the position, consistent with the language and legislative history, that if a union applied economic pressure directly against an employer to get him to change his collective bargaining or grievance handling representative, that was a violation of the law. And we take no issue at all, whatever, with that reading of the statute. As the court described the change in the board's thinking, in the Oakland Mailers case, the board moved on to the proposition that disciplinary action against an individual, a supervisor member, for the way he performs his grievance handling or supervisory, I'm sorry, grievance handling or collect.
8B1B says nothing about supervisors.
No, that's why I corrected myself, Mr. Justice Stewart.
In supervisory functions.
We agree with that point entirely. What I meant to say was that in Oakland Mailers, the board said that discipline of supervisor members for the way they perform grievance handling or collective bargaining functions violates the act, as well as economic pressure directly on the employer. And while I'll return to that holding, I think it suffices to say here that at least the board's approach to that point had the virtue of confining itself to the subjects that Congress had indicated it wished regulated, namely the selection of grievance handling and collective bargaining representatives.
A representative for the purpose of collective bargaining or the adjustment of grievances may or may not be a supervisor, in fact.
It's
relatively coincidental.
That's right, and the normal collective bargaining situation, the one that Congress was most particularly concerned about, the multi-employer situation, he will not be a supervisor. Then the board took what we regard as the quantum step in this progression and stated the rule that Section 8B1B is a general prohibition of union discipline of supervisor members for their conduct in the course of representing the interests of the employer. That's the board's language. And that theory came to this court in the Florida Power and Light case because the board said that doing rank and file struck work during a strike was conduct in the course of representing the interests of the employer, and that discipline of that type by the union was therefore a violation of Section 8B1B. This court rejected both the theory as applied in that case, and we most strenuously argue rejected the reasoning as well. Since Florida Power and Light, the sum total of the board's recognition of this court's decision and its reasoning in Florida Power and Light is to say that 8B1B is a general prohibition of union discipline of supervisor members except for members who spend a minimal amount of time performing supervisory duties. For everybody else, the individual performs struck work, the pre-Florida Power and Light rule continues to represent the board's thinking. So not only has the board ignored the reasoning of this court's opinion in that case, but we would submit it's even narrowed the holding, because there can be instances in which a union disciplines a member for performing struck work and in which the board will say that the discipline is unlawful, namely a situation in which he also performed more than a minimal amount of supervisory activity. So even in that situation, we say the board has given very little credence to this court's approach to the problem. We think the defects in the board's thinking since Oakland Mailers can be summed up as follows. First and most importantly, the board destroys another interest recognized by Congress in 1947. The interest that it destroys is the union's right to discipline members, which by and large was left untouched by Congress in 1947, and as a historic fact, and this Court has noted this fact, Congress very well understood in 1947 that unions disciplined their members. There's nothing left of that right under the board's theory as regards these supervisory members. We don't think that the board has the authority to view the statute as a one-value statute and to say that the interest protected in Section 8B1B, that of selecting a representative to engage in grievance handling or collective bargaining, is so important that all other interests must be denied and that there must be a broad prophylactic rule which prohibits discipline no matter what its purpose and no matter whether or not it's intended to affect the protected interests.
Would you agree that that if the union finds find one of these hyphenates here for performing at all a grievance adjustment, that there would be a violation?
Yes, Your Honor, I do.
And if if he did, if he went to work and part of his work was grievance adjustment, but the other part wasn't, but it nevertheless wasn't rank and file work, so to speak, and the union fined him for whatever he did, would there be a violation?
Well, our view on that is that at that point the question becomes the union's purpose, and the board would have to make findings of fact. In the union supplemental brief, it refers to this court's opinion in the American Ship case.
But didn't the union here take the position that you can't go to work without being fined, no matter what you're going to do at the work?
Well, I don't think the union took that position. The matter simply wasn't...
Suppose it did. Would you... I thought the union in the hearing, I thought the general counsel for the lawyer representing the union took the position that it didn't make any difference what the purpose of the person going to work was. They were going to fine him.
Well, that simply isn't my understanding. I don't believe that that's the...
Well, here's the administrative law judge. It was stipulated at the hearing in this matter that counsel for respondent who participated in the disciplinary hearings instituted by respondent would testify that he took the position at such hearings that the hyphenates charged are subject to discipline for crossing respondent's picket line without regard to whether they crossed the picket line for the purpose of performing bargaining services. Now, let's assume the union said, we don't care what you're going to work for. You may or you may not be performing collective bargaining work, but even if you are, you're going to be fined.
Well, I think at that point the union is taking a terrible chance at the least. If they in fact perform collective bargaining or grievance handling functions.
Well, here's the administrative law judge making a finding. It is clear, as has been found, that the normal performance of the hyphenate's primary functions involves the adjustment of employee grievances. Now, do you accept that or not?
I accept that, but the problem with that point in this case is that it isn't responsive to the issue, because we think the question is whether they perform such activities during the strike. And if so, whether the union disciplined them for doing that as opposed to performing other activities.
But if a threat succeeds, they'll never show up. And presumably, whether or not there's that sort of work to be done, they will not be there to do it.
In the situation of a threat It may well be that the proper rule is that the union has to more carefully state its intent than was done here. For example, if there are people who perform both grievance handling work and other work for the employer, it might be that the proper rule is that the union must say, we will discipline people who cross our picket line and perform non-8B1B work. I wouldn't argue that that is a rule that the board could not reach. All I say at this point is that the board is nowhere near having thought through the problem to that extent, because it's still taking the position that whatever the individual does after he crosses the picket line, and whatever the union's purpose, there is a violation as long as that person sometimes handles a grievance. And that, we believe, is absolutely wrong.
But your general counsel at the hearing apparently took the other extreme position.
Well, the only thing I can...
Judging from the colloquy that Justice White read.
Yeah. Let me just say that I'm here arguing for the AFL-CIO, not for this particular union, and I even if I were arguing for the union, maybe I would feel free to disagree, but I certainly do disagree arguing for the client I am arguing for, and
I don't doubt you have the authority to do it.
Yeah. I'm not sure what my authority would be representing the particular union, but at any rate, our view is that the board has to find that the individual who is disciplined actually performed grievance handling or collective bargaining work, and that the union fined him or otherwise disciplined him for doing so. And that means in a situation in which somebody crosses a picket line and performs only grievance handling or collective bargaining work, and the union fined him, the general counsel would have a relatively easy case. The board's general counsel would have a relatively easy case to prove where somebody crosses a picket line and performs some grievance handling work and some other work. Then you would have the classic case that you always have under Section 883 of the Act, which prohibits employer discipline of employees for engaging in union activity that normally arises. And as I was about to say when Mr. Justice White asked me the question that began this discussion, in the union's supplemental brief, they refer to the American Ship case, and it does seem to us that that's helpful in putting this section in perspective. In 1935, Congress said to employers, you can't discipline employees for engaging in protected activity, but didn't prohibit employers from disciplining people for breaking shop rules. The board has never, and we believe it's plain, they could not say that because employees will suspect that when a union activist is disciplined for breaking a shop rule, everybody in the plant will fear discipline, that the employers have lost their right to discipline people for breaking shop rules. And because employees both engage in union activity and to earn a living continue to work for the employer and are subject to his rules, the board in an 8A3 case must show not only that the person who was fired or otherwise disciplined was engaged in protected activity, but also that the employer's purpose was to punish him for doing so.
The thing that brought on these proceedings was the fine, I take it, after a proceeding within the union.
Yes.
And what's the union's burden before it can fine a person who's crossed the picket line? The union's position apparently in those hearings was, we don't care what you crossed the picket line for. We're going to fine you. That is what the record shows. Now, is the union free to do that? Well, doesn't it have some burden to show that it wasn't finding him or what its purpose was? They seem to take the position that it doesn't make it, whether you cross the picket line to adjust grievances or not, you're going to be fined.
Well, the situation the union found itself in here, as I understand it, is that these people, the disciplined people, did not appear at the trials. Is that correct? Yeah, most did not. And so the union is left with the situation that its people are not in at the plant.
I give you the administrative law judges the second time that he said it in his opinion. It was stipulated that respondents' counsel during the disciplinary hearings was not concerned with what work the hyphenates did when working during the strike.
Well, if I may, in that, it may have been the respondent's argument before the administrative, that may have been the respondent's argument before the administrative law judge. Well, I suspect that it was his.
This is a description of what the union's position was during the disciplinary hearings inside the union.
Well, my view on that is if the union goes forward in that way, and the people actually performed grievance handling activity, I think that the general counsel, by proving both the performance and the union's disinterest, has proved a bad motive. But let's take another case. Suppose the union finds a particular individual for working for the employer, and it turns out that he didn't do any Section 8B1B work for that employer. I don't see how the union has committed any violation at all. Certainly, if an employer disciplines somebody for breaking a shop rule, and it turns out that that employee was not engaged in any protected activity, he hasn't violated 883.
Yeah, but the union finds him and says, "Now, you crossed the picket line. We don't care what you did. You could have been engaged exclusively in collective bargaining, but we're fining you, and we're not going to make any record about what you did or what you didn't do, but you're fine."
Well, as I say, in that situation, if the individual in fact performed Section 8B1B activity, it would be my view that the union might well in that situation commit a violation.
Well, then, how about this finding of the administrative law judge that the duties of these hyphenates did include collective bargaining and adjustment of grievances?
But that, as I attempted to say before, that's a general statement of what their overall job description includes. As Mr. Reich has pointed out, at least one group of the disciplined individuals here were the story writers who could not have performed any grievance handling or collective bargaining functions during the strike because they didn't engage in collective bargaining and because there were no writers there to supervise and handle grievances. So the board doesn't care at all whether or not the individuals perform Section 8B1B functions. It finds a violation on the general theory that if no matter what the union finds people for, what its interest is, what its motive is, and what they've done during the strike, it's illegal because it may have some effect on their on the way that they will carry out their collective bargaining or grievance handling functions in the future. And what we say is that's just like saying that whenever an employer disciplines somebody for breaking a shop rule, that's a violation of Section 883 on the ground that employees may in the future fear to engage in protected activity, and whether or not that individual actually broke the shop rule and the employer was motivated by the breach of the rule. There are many ways, as the board has had 40-odd years of experience, in proving what motive is in these situations where people are sometimes engaged in protected activity and sometimes engaged in unprotected activity. And you don't solve the problem by taking away, in the one instance, the employer's right to discipline, which he had prior to 1935, or to take away from the union completely its right to discipline the supervisor members, which unions had prior to 1947, and which there's no indication that Congress intended to take away.
Mr. Gold, do you agree that some of the hyphenates refrained from crossing the picket line in response to the union prohibition?
Your Honor, in regard to that, we agree with the statement made in the union supplemental brief that it might well have been within the board's province to find that as a fact if it had inquired into the issue. But it did not attempt to do so. And all we can say is that if that issue were to go back to the board for it to make a determination of whether the threat had that effect, and it found that it did, and there was substantial evidence to support it, we would not say that the board hadn't shown a violation to that extent.
Well, wouldn't the board, in your submission, also have to find that had they crossed the picket lines, these hyphenates would have performed 8B1B functions?
Oh, yes. I apologize. What I meant is four would have proved a case as to those people who would have performed 8B1B functions during the strike. In other words, if the union threatened the story writers who had no 8B1B right. functions to perform,
concededly so.
And concededly so, as far as the record shows, we don't think there would be a violation. But if a union threatened somebody who was, to use an example that Mr. Justice White has given, if the union was to say to somebody who walked up to a picket line and said, I've been called in to adjust grievances, and the union says, if you do so, we will fine you. In that situation, we would agree.
Let's take this situation. Let's assume there were only, say, a half a dozen hyphenates.
Yeah.
And that all of them, in response to the union's rule and instructions not to cross the line, refrained from doing so. At that point, no one could be sure, I suppose, whether or not there'd be any need for a grievance adjustment. Suppose the record was silent as to whether or not such a need actually arose. Would there be an 8B1B violation there?
Well, our view on that, Mr. Justice Powell, would be that part of the general counsel's case would be to show that the employer had grievance handling or collective bargaining activities that he wanted performed, that he asked these people to do so. I think that's the first point in his case that he must prove.
Would it be arguable, though, that management was entitled to have at least some of its representatives there to deal with situations that perhaps unforeseeable that might arise?
I would say that in a situation in which the employer says, I want you to come to work to perform grievance handling functions or collective bargaining functions as they arise, and the union threatened to fine the individuals who obeyed that order, that you would have an unlawful threat. But if the employer said, I want you to come to work and do whatever I tell you to do, then it's our view that the union would violate the law only if they individuals actually did one of these two 8B1B functions and nothing else, or that they did they perform these 8B1B functions as well as other activity, and the union was motivated by their performance of 8B1B functions to discipline them. So that's the line we draw. If they do only 8B1B functions, we concede the union can neither threaten them nor actually discipline them. If they perform both protected and unprotected activity, then we say the situation presented here is the same as the classical 8A3 case, and the union and the general counsel, to prove a violation, must show that the union was motivated by a desire to punish them for performing the 8B1B functions or for the way they perform. And that would be the line. And we believe that that protects the employer's interest to select anyone he wants to perform 8B1B functions and protects the union's right to discipline members for breaching the union's rules against working during a strike. It gives each part of this overall spectrum precisely what, as well as one can judge, Congress believed ought to be given to the employer and to the union. And it destroys nothing of substance of either side. Now, it is argued on the employer side that they don't very much like what Congress gave them, because what they would what would really benefit them would be the right to have individuals handle both grievances and collective bargaining and perform other supervisory functions and have those individuals immune from discipline, because it's inconvenient or expensive to them to have somebody only adjust grievances or only engage in collective bargaining. They would like to combine these various functions in one person and assure that that individual cannot be disciplined for anything he does. And our view on that is that there are many things we would like as well that the statute doesn't provide us, and that there is no way that we can see in reading this statute which would give the employers what they want without destroying entirely this the other interest which Congress recognized in 1947.
Mr. Gold, maybe I misunderstood you. I thought you said that if a supervisor performed 100% 8B1B work, he would be immune from discipline. I think you conceded that.
Yes.
Supposing he didn't pay his union dues, couldn't he be disciplined for that?
Well, I'm sorry. He would be immune for discipline for his conduct as an employer representative. I don't know of any case in which
wouldn't he be just immune from discipline for performing the 8B1B work? I mean, as I say he didn't pay his dues or some other neutral requirement, he'd be like any other supervisor, wouldn't he?
I would think so. I've never even seen a complaint issued which said that supervisor members, even when they handled grievances, are immune from the normal legal requirements. Our view is that what Congress said was that, if you credit Oakland Mailers, is that we can't go after them for performing 8B1B functions or the way they perform 8B1B functions. And what the board is saying is that we can't do anything to them ever because of the supposed carryover or deprivation effects. And that is the difference.
That is the effects on the employer. 8B1B is directed exclusively to coercion of the employer. It doesn't have anything to do with freedom of any employee, supervisory or otherwise.
That's
it has to do with coercion upon the employer.
That's right. And it's one thing to say that the employer is coerced where you deprive him of somebody who is loyal in carrying out the grievance handling function, which is the Oakland Mailer's step, and is at least a step from the plain meaning of the statute. But it's quite another thing to say that if your ostensible purpose is far removed, you also commit a violation. Just in the minute I have, I would say that the board's theory in this regard, that no matter what your reason for disciplining the supervisor member is, you commit an 8B1B violation, is the same type of theory it presented to this court in Teamsters Union versus Labor Board and Labor Board versus New Syndicate, the hiring hall cases, where they said that any union involvement in the hiring process through its own representatives was per se a violation because people subjected to that system would fear that the union would act improperly. And this court in those cases said, no, it's like 8A3, and the board must prove its case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gold. Mr. Combe, you have about 4 minutes left.
I would just like to dwell on one point. As was pointed out earlier, we're not dealing here with Section 8A3, which prescribes discrimination to encourage or discourage union membership, where it's well settled that ordinarily motive is a crucial ingredient. We're dealing here with 8B1B, which prescribes restraint and coercion of the employer, and it's equally well settled that there the test is normally the reasonable tendency of the conduct. Now, the union here, as I understand its position, concedes that if the union threatened a supervisor for going to work to perform grievance adjustment and collective bargaining functions, that would be a violation of 8B1B, even if the threat were not effective. The employer would be restrained and coerced by such a threat. They say, however, that there was no finding here that the union intended to discipline them for performing grievance adjustment and collective bargaining purposes. There are two answers to that contention. In the first place, on this record, they cannot be heard to make such an argument because in view of the trial examiner's findings that Mr. Justice White alluded to, the union made it quite clear that they were indifferent to whatever work it was that the hyphenates performed. They were going to be disciplined for that. And where a union couches its threat that broadly, in a circumstance where the individuals involved are cloaked with collective bargaining and grievance adjustment functions, it must be deemed to have intended to affect their collective bargaining and grievance adjustment functions. But beyond that, we submit that it is irrelevant whether the union intended to discipline the hyphenates for performing over only grievance adjustment or collective bargaining functions, because in the real world, an employer doesn't select a representative just for grievance adjustment or collective bargaining functions. These are only part of the representative's total functions. And a union assurance that a representative can go in to perform collective bargaining, assuming that you have a representative, as you had here, who is armed with those functions as well as others, that he can only go in to perform those, but if he performs any of his other functions, he's going to be fined, is going to restrain the employer no less than if they merely said you can't go in there and perform collective bargaining and grievance adjustment functions, because no employer is likely to hire only a half management representative. And therefore, we submit that you have to look at the reasonable tendency of the union's conduct. And on the facts here, the board properly concluded that the reasonable tendency of it was to restrain the employer in the selection of his representative for 8B1B functions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Combe. Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.